Please turn with me to the second book of Moses, Exodus chapter 5. Exodus chapter 5, beginning in verse 15. Then the officers of the children of Israel came and cried unto Pharaoh, saying, Wherefore dealest thou thus with thy servants? There is no straw given unto thy servants, and they say to us, Make brick. And behold, thy servants are beaten, but the fault is in thine own people. But he said, Ye are idle. Therefore ye say, Let us go and do sacrifice to the Lord. Go therefore now and work, for there shall no straw be given you, yet shall ye deliver the tale of bricks. And the officers of the children of Israel did see that they were in evil case, after it was said, Ye shall not minish aught from your bricks of your daily task. And they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way as they came forth from Pharaoh. And they said unto them, The Lord look upon you and judge, because ye have made our savor to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us. And Moses returned unto the Lord and said, Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he hath done evil to this people. Neither hast thou delivered thy people at all. You guys have probably heard examples of a man who is overworked, underappreciated by his boss. This goes on for a season, and one particular day he has a particularly bad day. And so he comes home. And he kicks the dog, and he fusses at the children, and he yells at his wife. It's really not an uncommon thing when we are hurt, wounded, frustrated, to lash out inappropriately and at the wrong target altogether. We have this in our text. The officers of Israel, having been beaten, make their entreaty to Pharaoh for relief. Pharaoh dismisses them curtly and somewhat rudely. Go back to your work. The sin is Pharaoh's. The sin is in the Egyptians, at least on some level. The officers of the children of Israel understand this. And yet they lash out at Moses and Aaron, their friends and their deliverers, the servants of God, the lovers of their freedom and well-being. Let's set our text in front of us again. And how is it that the officers of Israel find themselves in this condition? Moses and Aaron, in obedience to God, have gone to Pharaoh, and they've addressed Pharaoh in God's words, not their own words. And Jehovah's request or requirement is altogether reasonable, that he be worshipped. Pharaoh responds most unreasonably. He accuses Moses and Aaron of insurrection, and all of the rest of Israel of idleness, and now things get even worse. He wants to punish them, and he's seeking pretext to do so. So he withholds the straw that's necessary for the making of bricks. The Israelites must now gather straw, or its equivalent, the stubble of the fields. This is a very time-consuming and labor-intensive process. Not surprisingly, they are not able to make as many bricks as they were formerly. And upon their failure, they are beaten. At least their officers, their representatives are beaten. Now, these abused officers have petitioned Pharaoh for relief. They've tried to point out how unreasonable this situation is. This doesn't bring Pharaoh to reason. He simply exclaims, "Ye are idle, ye are idle." What's his evidence? They want to worship. I think you can see that the one doesn't follow from the other necessarily at all. And indeed, worship is no idleness, but our proper work, and a thing most necessary for every rational creature. Now the officers of the children of Israel are going to have an opportunity to address their own leaders, Moses and Aaron, which is going to lead to yet another address and petition from Moses to God. But first, the children of Israel and their address to Moses and Aaron. We pick up with verse 19. "And the officers of the children of Israel did see that they were in evil case, after it was said, 'Ye shall not minish aught from your bricks of your daily task.'" From Pharaoh's rough handling of them, they are able to make an observation. They are in a bad way. This is a tight spot. There's no matter which way they turn, there's no possibility of success here. They are anticipating further abuse. The reason for their observation is that their workload is much increased, but the quota of bricks is not to be diminished. Verse 20, "And they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way, as they came forth from Pharaoh." So now we're given a notice that as they leave Pharaoh, they meet Moses and Aaron. The Hebrew text is a little bit more explicit and express that this meeting is not accidental, that Moses and Aaron have come into the way. They want to see how their friends have fared. Of course, they know that all of this has been precipitated by their action, and they no doubt are wondering, did they meet with a favorable response from Pharaoh? In verse 21, "And they said unto them, 'The Lord look upon you and judge, because ye have made our savor to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us.'" Remember that the Lord had warned them beforehand that Pharaoh would not cooperate. But in the midst of travail, there is forgetfulness. They don't remember the thing that the Lord has said. They are simply in pain. This is something that we ought to put in our pockets and carry away with us. The Lord has told us that the Christian life would be one of tribulations. It's described as the picking up of a cross and following Jesus in the way of the cross. But when we enter into travail and pain, we frequently become forgetful. We act as confused people. We start to wonder perhaps maybe we're not Christians because these difficult things have come upon us. All such confusion is unnecessary. God has warned us beforehand of the character of life we would live and bear. And so it is here. They were warned beforehand that Pharaoh is not going to cooperate. It's only with the mighty and outstretched arm of God that they would be set free. They obviously are in a heat as they leave Pharaoh and have some very harsh words for Moses and Aaron. And this is not the last time that Moses will hear harsh words from such. In some ways, Moses is being introduced to the rest of his life. The next 40 years are going to be difficulties and the carping and complaining of the Israelites to him and about him. And interestingly enough, look at the expression, "The Lord look upon you and judge." Do you know what this is? This is what we call an imprecation. They curse Moses and Aaron. They call upon God to judge them for what they've done. Obviously, at this point, they esteem the actions of Moses and Aaron as wicked foolishness. And so they call upon God to judge them and punish them. Why? First, they say that they have caused the Israelites to stink to the Egyptians. There's something of a mixing of metaphor here, because you expect them to, their savor, their smell to be abhorred in the nostrils of Pharaoh and the servants, but it's not unusual in Hebrew literature for the senses, one sense to be exchanged for another, but quite literally, you've caused us to stink. We are loathed by the Egyptians. We are treated as filth. Put a little bit more literally, we are treated as slothful, worthless, and rebellious. Things were hard for us before, but now they treat us as if we are the offscouring of the world. And more than that, they say here that Moses and Aaron had put a sword into the hand of the Egyptians to slay them. This is something of a proverbial speech, which means something like, you have given the Egyptians a pretense to harm us. They've always wanted to harm us, and now you've given them the excuse that they need to do so. This, of course, is going to send Moses to the Lord. But we'll leave off in our narrative just now and take away from this a doctrine. Public servants can expect trial, even the threats of enemies and the unjust censures of friends. Moses and Aaron have just entered into their public work, and already they are being tried as public servants. Probably most all public servants will be tried. They've already been mistreated by Pharaoh. They have suffered his false accusations, and do you remember his rude dismissal of them? Get ye to your burdens. Pharaoh has no regard for the Israelites and no more regard for their leaders. He sends them to the burdens as well. But perhaps the mistreatment of enemies is to be expected. But now they suffer the unjust censure of their friends. And a harsh one at that. There's the imprecation or the calling upon God to judge them, and their foolish and wicked procedure, because they think that Moses and Aaron, through their own will and folly, have brought the nation certainly into hardship and probably into danger or peril. The treatment of Moses and Aaron here is not unique to them. All public servants face this sort of thing. And this is the testimony both of nature and of Scripture. In some ways, you don't even need the Scriptures to know that public servants are going to take their lumps. All you need to do is grow up to adulthood in this world and watch the way that public people are treated. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, most people have opinions about most everything. And I think in this day and age of technology and communication, that's probably more of a problem than ever. For most people, being private people. This is not such a big deal because they don't act in the public sphere. Their activities are not open and observable to the public. This is beginning to change with Facebook, and people are quite foolishly making themselves very public by exposing everything from how they felt in the morning when they woke up to what they had for dinner, and thus opening themselves to just so many censures, the opinions of everybody in their circle of acquaintances. But for the most part, private life is still private life. Few people see it, and so there's not much in the way of criticism from the masses. But part of what it means to be a public person is you act in public. Your actions are subject to the evaluation of everyone. They all evaluate what you've done. And you shouldn't be naive to think that a lack of information about why you've done what you've done is going to slow the judgment down one bit. People still feel quite free to form opinions about things that they know very little about. You really don't have to go further than our national public officials. Sniping at them has become a national pastime. We've got all sorts of political talk radio and going both directions, making fun of these politicians. Why they do what they do is not always apparent. We think that it is, but there's much that's transacted behind closed doors, some of it necessarily secret, some of it not necessarily secret. They're covering their misdeeds and whatnot, but you remember even Solomon recognized that that kings have their secrets, and it must needs be so for the safety of the nation. And so we're pretty quick to form all sorts of judgments and opinions about things that are, if we think soberly, quite difficult to assess. But having formed our opinions, we express quite freely. That's also part of American society. We are encouraged to do so. You have freedom of speech. You have an opinion about something, feel free to put it out there. And now you've got Facebook, so you can put it out there for your 1,000 or 2,000 closest friends and associates. Who would want that job? Why does anybody run for any elected office at all? To give you an illustration, you imagine a president leading us through a war. And for the sake of the illustration, imagine it to be a just and even defensive war. He could very well and should expect the denunciation of his enemies. But how much more difficult to bear the constant criticisms from those that you're serving. You're serving and defending, and yet it's not unusual for a president who's taken a nation into war to bear constant criticism from the very people that he's endeavoring to serve through the war. And in this case, let's just imagine it's a just one. Well, so nature and experience shows us pretty clearly what is the lot of public people. You turn to the scripture and it's right on the face of it. You think of the Apostle Paul. Recently, in going through the Acts of the Apostles, my wife said that she never quite read it with this particular eye, but she was amazed at how the Jews chased Paul from town to town, causing trouble for him. They hated him, and they chased him around from one place to another. Well, they were his enemies. It's as much as can be expected. But in Galatia and Corinth, Paul had labored for the conversion of souls. And then he writes back to those churches, and many of those people had been converted by his own preaching, only to find that in spite of his service to them, they had cast off his authority. He was even, you find this in 2 Corinthians, experiencing a measure of ridicule from them. Well, you know, he's mighty by letter, but we didn't find him to be very considerable in speech and so on. Amazing. But this is the lot of public people. And there's always a peculiar pain when when the criticisms are coming from those that are esteemed to be associates and friends. A couple of portions from the Psalter. All that hate me whisper together against me. Against me do they devise my hurt. Well, that's as much as to be expected. But then the psalmist goes on, yea, mine own familiar friend in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. Psalm 41, verses 7 through 9. Have you ever had something like that happen? Where you've suffered an attack, a censure, a criticism from one that you esteemed to be your friend and your ally in a particular situation? Or again, for it was not an enemy that reproached me, then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me, then I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide and mine acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together, and walked unto the house of God in company. Psalm 55, 12 through 14. You can hear the pain and the pathos in the words of the psalmist. He even says, if it had been mine enemy, I could have borne it. If it was somebody that hated me, then I could have simply hid myself away. And yet, it came from you, my friend, one that I had gone up to the house of God with, and so on. Well, a handful of practical applications suggest themselves. First of all, let all in authority be prepared to bear this in some measure. Sometimes the criticisms are going to be just, sometimes they're going to be unjust. Sometimes they're going to come from friends, but we need to be prepared to bear it as part of our calling. Husbands will bear it in some measure from wives. Parents will bear it in some measure from children, especially as the children get older. But we need to be prepared to bear it. It's part of the office. It's part of what comes with that calling. But second, we need to count the cost before taking public office. If you're not willing to bear this, then you are really not willing to take up a public office. This is part of the cost of service. You would think that the service itself would be cost enough, that you are spending and being spent for the well-being of others, but that's not the only cost. You will spend and be spent and then be criticized by the very people that you are serving. This needs to be taken into consideration and soberly. But I don't say this necessarily to scare you away. I just want you to be clear and realistic about these things. It is difficult. It is painful. And sometimes it's excruciating. If you've had some taste of it, you'll know. Sometimes it is just excruciating. But I'll tell you something that I've known in experience. If it is well improved, it is also intensely sanctifying. Intensely sanctifying. You will learn what it means to love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you. And those that are most hurtful to us are those ones that we had esteemed formerly friends and that we had drawn closest to our bosoms when they turn vipers and poisonous. Then we learn what it means to love our enemies and to pray for those that persecute us. So I tell you this beforehand, if you should consider a public office, it won't feel good. But if well improved, it will be good. Good for your soul. And then finally, Let us be more careful in the use of our tongues concerning our superiors. This is basically the golden rule, treating others the way that we would like to be treated. If you have ever experienced this in some measure, you will know what a great unkindness it is to be censorious, harsh, and severe with such. I mentioned earlier that this is something of a national pastime. Our culture encourages it. Everywhere you turn, you'll hear, you know, this is freedom of speech, and if you have an opinion, express it, and we want to hear from you, and so on. This is really not Bible thinking. This is American thinking, but not scriptural thinking. And part of the problem behind all of this is a lack of the fear of God. Not a fear of the powers that be, a lack of the fear of God. One of the reasons that we speak so freely is because we think so little and fear God so little. And so we just let all of the rubbish that's in our hearts pour right out of our mouths. But we need to remember that God stands behind these institutions. And so in that sense, we ought to make our approach unto them with a certain reverence and fear of God, the God who has instituted and ordained these institutions, and then commands us to honor them, to honor them. And so Paul says in the 13th of Romans, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation." That is certainly a very sobering pronouncement. And then 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 17, "Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." And the juxtaposition in particular of fear God and honor the king in the light of Romans chapter 13 is very suggestive. When we fear God, the God who has instituted and ordained these institutions, we will treat them with reverence and honor for his sake. And this is really irrespective of the intrinsic quality of the men that hold the offices. As I've mentioned to you before, there does have to be a balance. There is a time to speak, a time to critique, and so on. But it must be slow, careful, thoughtful. The goal must be to edify, and we must seek to honor the institutions and the people that are invested in them, even while we must speak against certain sins and so on. But remember the declaration in James, slow to speak, you know, quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. James 1:20. I thought that we might conclude with Psalm 55, which we have just read. Psalm 55, verses 7 through 15. We'll sing to the tune St. Kilda. "He was no foe that may reproach, than that endure I could. Nor hater that didst gainst me boast, from him me hide I would. But thou, man, who mine equal, guide, and mine acquaintance wast, we joined sweet counsels, to God's house in company